Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us for this week's edition of the Northwest Passage. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm Morning Edition host Ani Katz.
And I'm reporter Aubrey Bulkley.
And I'm news reporter Brian Bull.
In a few minutes, Aubrey will talk with us about her feature on efforts to help hungry students at the University of Oregon and a feature she's working on looking back at the Thurston High School shooting 21 years ago this month. But first, Ani and Brian, let's talk about this week's headlines.
So the big story here statewide were the teacher walkouts. Bethel and Eugene here locally joined more than two dozen districts across Oregon that closed for the day. That would be May 8th. The Oregon Education Association was the organizer. It said about 100 events across the state were held. Teachers want legislation passed. It's called the Student Success Act that would increase school funding by 18%, or about $1 billion a year. What they want from that is smaller class sizes, more librarians, more counselors, more nurses. And they also want increased funding for arts, music, and PE, which they say have been kind of shaved away over the years. Besides academic benefit, they argue that students' well-being will benefit as well. I went to a rally at the Park Blocks here in downtown Eugene the other day, and if I had to weather a guess, I would say that there was probably about 400 people there easily, probably more. There were signs, speakers, musicians, lots of fired-up educators. Here's Jennifer Skurlock. She's a Churchill High teacher of 16 years, explaining how funding shortfalls are being felt beyond academics.
We're finding that our kids are struggling with mental illness issues or trauma, where we're having higher rates of suicide or suicide attempts. And so our kids are making it clear they need some more support, they need more help, but we do not have enough counselors, even having a nurse on staff. Our nurse is shared amongst multiple schools.
Afterwards, they all got on buses and made a trip up to Salem, where I believe about roughly 2,000 of them gathered in the State House and began chanting, calling for passage of this bill.
The sticking point is Republican opposition. GOP lawmakers didn't show up for the vote on the Student Success Act. They say they support schools but want to address PERS reform and not tax businesses, as outlined in the legislation, which is House Bill 3427. So Democrats remain confident the education spending bill will succeed, but we'll see what happens in Salem.
Yeah, as of this taping, I believe dozen GOP lawmakers are still AWOL from voting.
So a couple other things that happened in Salem this week. Oregon's House approved a bill to make the state's vaccine laws among the most stringent in the U.S. The vote was 35-25. Two Republicans supported the bill and five Democrats voted against the majority of their party. It now goes to the Senate. If it becomes law, HB 3063 will make Oregon the fourth state in the U.S. with no philosophical or religious exemptions available to parents who don't want to vaccinate their kids or want to vaccinate them on a slowed down timeline. Currently, a nation-leading 7.5% of Oregon kindergartners claim at least one exemption. Also in Salem this week, M44 predator control devices have been banned here in Oregon. We're the final West Coast state to ban these so-called cyanide bombs. Governor Kate Brown signed the legislation this week after it passed with bipartisan support. The devices target predators like coyotes, spraying poison into the animal's mouth when they eat bait. The Oregon Farm Bureau worries the ban further limits tools that farmers have to protect their livestock. Conversely, those opposed say the devices are potentially harmful to people, like kids, specifically pets and endangered wildlife.
Yeah, I spoke with Brooks Fay last week, who's with Predator Defense, and he pointed out many family pets have died from exposure to these. You can't tell what it is when you see it out in the wild and, or out just on your land. I guess it's even been on people's own private property that they've come across them and watched their dogs die in front of them.
Mm. They look like a garden sprinkler, didn't you say?
That's what they've been described as, yeah. Or a land marker.
So what do you know what kind of bait they use to get the animal to be
You just come across it randomly.
Oh, okay.
And didn't someone's a kid get sprayed by one of those
ones?
Oh,
yeah. There's a kid in Idaho who became very ill from being exposed to the cyanide. There's a man in Colorado who actually died from the effects.
Mm. Wow.
So I don't know if anybody else started the week off like I did by checking the weather. It's very warm this week. The Lane Fire Defense Board has temporarily banned outdoor burning. The suspension started on Thursday and is scheduled to last for about a week. This is due to unseasonably high temperatures and low humidity. That's also why there's a red flag warning this afternoon and a fire weather watch on Friday afternoon. A senior meteorologist for the National Weather Service, Trina Jensen, had this to say.
If you have wildfires anywhere in the area and smoke gets into those lower levels, then it definitely is a problem. So it's hard to forecast if we're going to have as much wildfires as we did last summer, but I could see us having some periods where the air quality is not great.
Right. So these bans typically happen later in the season because larger forest fuels like trees aren't ready to burn, but there's still a lot of highly flammable grass and brush. And it's worth mentioning that there was a fast-moving brush fire in the Lapine area on Wednesday afternoon that burned 12 acres and led to mandatory evacuations that were in the fire's path.
Not ready.
Not at all.
Yeah, it feels really early for that kind of thing to be happening. Brian, you had another story that you worked on this week that's of interest to folks here in Lane County.
Absolutely. Lane County tourism has seen a spending trend that spanned a decade and for the first time ever hit the $1 billion mark. Among the county's big draw is the Oregon Dunes National Recreation Area, part of the Siosla National Forest that takes you out to the coastline just south of Florence. There's also the Cascades, the Willamette and McKenzie Rivers and Eugene itself being a big pull for tourism. This all builds on a statewide trend which shows tourism and travel generated more than $12 billion last year. It's all in a report prepared for the Oregon Tourism Commission, and you can imagine state officials are delighted to chat up the state's attractions, even if those animated videos with the sky whales and giant tulip bunnies are a little misrepresentative. In fact, it's the campaign's build, the only slightly exaggerated campaign, mimics the animation style of Studio Ghibli movies like My Neighbor Totoro and Kiki's Delivery Service. I see Aubrey there beaming. They're great fun, and they really do kind of capture the spirit of those movies. There's some other stats. Tourism, travel, and hospitality creates 11,000 jobs for Lane County. The report does not break down, however, what's part-time versus full-time, seasonal versus year-long, but tourist officials say regardless, these are all jobs that build an economy, and for many students especially, summer hour employment helps pay tuition and pizza.
Great. Well, I have just another news story to mention about this week that's pretty sad. An African-American Lane Community College student was shot and killed behind Taylor's Bar by the University of Oregon campus. That was this last weekend. Police are still looking for the shooter, and we haven't heard any information about what happened. It rocked the University of Oregon and Lane Community College. There was a vigil this week in honor of Alex Oyambe Graydon. And our reporter Mallory Begay was there.
LCC student president Nick Keough says Graydon's death was a huge loss for the school.
He made big impacts on this campus. We've met a lot of his friends and family in the past few days and have heard stories about his infectious smile and his compassion and his friendliness.
Police are actually still looking for tips from anyone who might have seen what happened. KLCC's news intern Aubrey Bulkley is here. And Aubrey, you produced a story this week looking at the University of Oregon's efforts to feed hungry ducks on campus. So tell us a little bit about that and how you came across this story.
I initially came across the story last year during one of my reporting classes where my beat was the University of Oregon. And not quite sure how I stumbled across the food insecurity, but found out it was quite an issue, and there were some initial steps being taken to try and address that. But really, the campus was still at a point where they were just starting to recognize it was an issue. And then this year, I found out that another step had been taken to start some of these pilot programs to address the issue, and I thought it would be interesting to follow up on that.
And, of course, Aubrey's story, her first long-form feature for KLCC, is posted at our website, klcc.org. And, Aubrey, you're a University of Oregon Journalism School graduate student, and you've been working on a project that looks at how people who survived the Thurston shooting 21 years ago in Springfield, how they're coping now.
Yeah, for my terminal project to get the master's degree, I had to do a long form story and decided to look back at the Thurston shooting because I started the project last year, which was the 20th anniversary. Wanted to highlight stories that we don't normally hear in the news as much of people who were at Thurston when that happened, but were not injured during their time, but they still are deeply affected by the event.
And you're working on a story also for KLCC that we'll be hearing as we get closer to that anniversary, which is this month.
Yes.
This week, I had the pleasure of talking with Francesco Lecce Chong, who is the music director of the Eugene Symphony, and they're putting on their final concert of the classical season this week, Verdi's Requiem. We also got to hear a little bit about something coming up in June, which is SymFest, which is sort of a festival of music, local performers, and also food and drink. So that's coming up in June. And he also talked about this contest that the symphony's putting on for new composers of new music. So you can find that interview at our website, klcc.org.
Lecce Chong is just so fun to talk to. He's just very lively and fun and enthusiastic. He kind of flies against that stereotype of the stodgy conductor. I mean, he's just so animated, and you just can tell that he loves what he does.
I also had the pleasure of talking with local Eugene author Lauren Kessler, who's a prolific writer of nonfiction, and her latest book is about leading a writer's group at the Oregon State Penitentiary. She worked with some convicted murderers who are serving life in prison and was able to help them to find their voice as writers. And so it's a fascinating book, and it was really interesting to talk with her. And that interview also is at our website, klcc.org. And her book is A Grip of Time. You are listening to the Northwest Passage, KLCC's weekly podcast. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald. I'm here with Brian Bull, Ani Katz, and Aubrey Bulkeley. And we're going to wrap up this edition of The Passage by talking about news that stuck with us this week, whether it's national or KLCC news. And Brian, let's start with you.
I got a couple here. One that took my interest, while President Donald Trump is taking a cue from candidate Donald Trump and continuing to keep his tax returns private, the New York Times reviewed available tax documentation to discern that Trump lost $1 billion over a decade from the late 80s into the 90s. Now, this contradicts his campaign image of a successful self-made millionaire and real estate tycoon. In fact, the Times says Trump lost so much cash that he was able to avoid paying taxes for 8 years. Now, the president, always with thumb on his Twitter account send button, has countered that big losses on paper were common in real estate in that period. He says developers got massive write-offs that let them declare a loss over and over again. NPR had a guest on from the Columbia Business School who says that's true, that real estate developers had many legal venues for avoiding tax payments. And the president calls it all a, quote, highly inaccurate fake news hit job, end quote. But it remains now to be seen if this limits his 2020 campaign narrative and if his appeal to the base that saw him as an infallible businessman might be challenged. Moving on to something a little more stalwart, I guess, but no less stubborn. NPR had a great installment in its ongoing Anthem series. Tom Petty's 1989 hit, I Won't Back Down, was examined, and many fans didn't consider a true concert if Petty didn't perform it. It's a compelling song that speaks to resilience, grit, or just plain stubbornness. Petty apparently worried it was too simple, but I think that's largely its appeal. It can be anyone's lifeline who's going through a tough period. If you look at the NPR website with the story, you're going to see not only do they share Petty's thoughts on the song, but they also share accounts from listeners who said the song gave them hope and really pulled them through a bad situation. One listener got part of the song tattooed on her shoulder about being stood at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Petty also played a special version of the song after 9/11 for a benefit concert. It was a little more subdued, but you can imagine how that brought the country together with its call for unified defiance against terrorism. It's also been covered by other artists, including Johnny Cash, whose version Petty admired deeply. And one of my college friends told me recently that I Won't Back Down got her through writing her dissertation. I think I listened to it while bouncing from temp job to temp job while trying to find my way into public broadcasting. So yeah, it's a great piece, and if you have time, check it out. It's just fun to listen to that.
It's your turn, Aubrey.
Don't back down.
What I found interesting, like a lot of millennials, I get my news on social media. And something that came across my social media was from Runner's World, and it was about a woman. Her name is Jessica Anderson. She is a nurse, and she ran the London Marathon in her scrubs because she wanted to break the Guinness World Record for the fastest marathon in a nurse's uniform. And but she was initially disqualified because the Guinness World Records required that or stated that a nurse's uniform was a skirt, not pants. And there was social media outcry against that. Lots of people, you know, posting their nurses' uniforms and, you know, and whatnot. She said she took it literally, just like a firefighter, you know, would have to wear their, you know, whole thing. But upon further review, Guinness changed their mind and realized that the standards were outdated. And she has been reinstated as the fastest nurse to run a marathon.
Wow. Good for her. Awesome.
Yeah, I just thought it was...
That's a great story.
Fascinating.
So I have, I guess for me, one of the way that I started this week was when I heard on NPR and then read the New York Times article about this report that came out this week about animal and plant species. 1 million animal and plant species are at risk of extinction, according to a UN report. And it talks about, you know, the combination of climate change and also the way that the humans are encroaching on habitat for so many different species that we're really altering the Earth in a huge way that is not reversible, according to this report. That was just a pretty eye-opening story. And then on a little bit of a lighter note, there was a great segment with singer-songwriter Ani DeFranco this week on Morning Edition, and she's definitely one of my favorites, and it was great to hear some of her older music that was definitely, for me, very inspiring, and, you know, I was singing along in the morning while I was getting ready to go to work.
Squint your eyes and look closer. I'm not between you and your ambition. I am a poster girl with no poster. I am 32 flavors and then some.
And Ani, you get to wrap it up.
So, guys, it's a boy. Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor, new son to the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, otherwise known as Harry and Meghan, was born earlier this week. I'm a bit of a fan of the British monarchy, so we were all kind of waiting. We didn't know if it was going to be a boy or girl. Then, of course, we didn't know what the name was going to be. But beautiful 7-plus-pound baby boy was born, very healthy. Meghan's doing well. They came out for about a 3-minute photo call, and now there's, I think he's going to be called Master Archie for at least 8 or 9 years.
Master Archie.
No word on a title yet.
He has the most adorable button nose. It's like the one thing I got from that photo. It was so cute.
And I believe it's the first multiracial baby born into the royal British family. Royalty, yeah.
I think like as far as we know. Official way, yes. I think it's the first official, yes. And then I don't know if anybody has been able to look at these pictures online, but there were, after the photo call, they also sent out this picture of the Queen meeting baby Archie for the first time with Prince Philip and also Meghan's mother, actually. And so that's just a very sweet picture of the proud grandparents who are really, at the end of the day, just proud grandparents meeting their new grandbaby.
That's exciting.
That's a really cute picture.
So cute.
The Queen approves?
She looks pretty happy.
She does.
Very happy. And then finally, So new Morning Edition music premiered on Monday. We've known about this change for a while, so we've kind of said our goodbyes to the old tune. I have to admit that when we heard the music a few months ago, I was not a humongous fan of it. But now that I've listened to it for a week straight of Morning Editions, I love it. And if anybody still here is not a fan, you could just picture me in the studio in the morning kind of dancing a little bit while it plays at the top of the hour every day. It's the new theme. They're sticking to it, so we can't go back. And I think it's a really bouncy, newsy way to start each hour of Morning Edition.
Back in the day, I used to work for NPR's Morning Edition in Washington. And when they changed the theme, I can't remember the last time they changed it, but
it's like 20 years ago.
That's when I was there. People were in an uproar. There were a lot of angry calls and mails, and I can't believe you've done it. And now here we are again, life repeating itself. I like the theme myself too. It's grown on me.
Didn't you say you felt like it had kind of an old newsy vibe to it, along with the modern take?
Yeah, I actually do think that it's a little bit of a lighter start to the hour, just in terms of the musician part of it. And I do think it starts off a little bit more like a news show. So I'm definitely into it. It's really grown on me.
And they still incorporate BJ Lederman's theme into it.
You can hear it throughout, which is really cool when that swell comes up. I love it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us for this week's edition of the Northwest Passage. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
Morning Edition host Ani Katz.
Reporter Aubrey Bulkley.
And reporter Brian Bull. Thanks for listening.